Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum. We've talked a lot over the years on the show about inequality in America, how large it is, how much it's growing, what it means in terms of individual people and families, as well as to society at large and the health of our democracy. A new documentary film opened this past Friday in 23 cities, including Los Angeles, starring former Labor Secretary in the Clinton administration, Berkeley professor, best-selling author, and frequent guest on this program, Robert Reich. Titled Inequality for All, I Assume It Hopes to Do for This Issue What an Inconvenient Truth Did for Climate Change. And early reviews are positive. It's got a Rotten Tomatoes score of 93%. And here's Ken Turan in the LA Times. Smart, funny, and articulate, Robert Reich is the university professor we all wish we'd had. He's so accessible and entertaining, he takes a subject that sounds soporific and makes it come alive like you wouldn't believe. Here's just a few numbers to remind you how crazy things have gotten. In 1978, a typical male worker made $48,000. A typical member of the top 1%, $393,000. In 2010, a typical male worker made $34,000, a drop of 30%, while a typical member of the top 1% made $1,101,000, a gain of 180%. In 2013, the richest 400 Americans have more wealth than the bottom 150 million. You heard that right. The richest 400 have more wealth than the bottom 150 million. And as remarkable as those numbers are, I think the most important number in the film is this one. Consumer spending equals 70% of the U.S. economy. They're not the job creators. The job creators are you and me and everybody in the aisles of every store and everybody clicking a button right now to buy something online. That's what this economy is about. My guest in the studio today will be Jacob Kornbluth, director of Inequality for All. And then in the latter third of the show, I'll be joined by expert and activist Harvey Wasserman with an important update on the situation at the stricken nuclear power plant in Fukushima, Japan. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Jacob Kornbluth is the award-winning director of the narrative films Haiku Tunnel and The Best Thief in the World, both of which premiered in competition at Sundance. He's been a fellow at the Sundance Screenwriting and Directing Labs, and Kornbluth conceived a successful web video series with Robert Reich from MoveOn.org and The Nation that was the genesis of the film Inequality for All. Welcome to Free Forum, Jacob Kornbluth.
Thanks for having me.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we're going to talk about. So I mentioned a few highlights, but can you briefly bring to life for us your path to the work that you find yourself doing today? And feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision.
Well, I think for me it started in that I grew up poor, relatively speaking poor. My mother raised a family of four on between $9,000 and $15,000 a year. That's the number I know because I got free lunches at school and I had to fill out a form every year that I turned into the school principal that listed how much we made. And all of my classmates knew how much we made because they saw that I got free lunches every day. So I knew that we didn't have much. Interestingly, though, I never felt poor, and I actually almost never said it out loud until I started talking about making this film, because my parents were so proud of education was so important, and they were so proud of sort of their working class roots. But I certainly was aware from a very early age of who gets what in a society, of how income, how much everybody had, essentially. My father had a stroke when I was about six.
I was going to ask.
And yeah. he had brain damage and was paralyzed, and he couldn't speak after that. And then he passed away when I was 11. And then my mother raised me and my younger brother and sister by herself with my grandmother. But that made me – that death of my father made me move from New York City, Washington Heights, to rural Michigan, where my mom was from. So I split my childhood between a mostly Dominican neighborhood, Washington Heights at the top of Manhattan, that was sort of at the entry point to both breakdancing and crack cocaine in America when I was a kid, to an extremely rural place where we had to drive to our nearest neighbors. And my graduating class from high school had 44 kids, public school. And I was, I believe, the only one to go to a four-year university out of my graduating class. So,
wow.
Very different places, but a very interesting look for somebody who's going to make this film into the two into two very different Americas, one very urban and ethnic, and one very Caucasian, but also working class in both cases. So that was a pretty interesting background and led to a pretty confusing set of teenage years. And but I made it to college. Then my mother passed away when I was 18.
Oh my God!
And I had a younger brother and sister, so I dropped out of school and I tried to raise them and help out in any way I could. And I failed miserably, as many 18-year-olds probably would. So I wound up going back to school and finishing, and then never really thought of this background as anything that would turn into somebody who might make a documentary. I thought maybe what it really gave me an affection for was character. I really liked the flaws and the complexity of the human condition, and that was what I gravitated towards. That's what I had, you know, empathy towards. And actually, I probably, as a lot of people who had sort of difficult upbringings, it sort of made comedy really important to me. I started out working in comedy and started out directing theater and working with my brother, who is a theater performer. The first play we did together was called The Moisture Seekers, about a kid around my age's first time having sex. And one of my favorite titles in the history of things, by the way, The Moisture Seekers. And it was incredible success. And it gave me a sense that storytelling was a way that I might work and I might make a living. And so I ended up gravitating from theater to film. I made my first film, Haiku Tunnel, with my brother, another adaptation of a play. Went to Sundance, came out of nowhere, got bought by Sony, and I sort of had a career. I realized like it was important to me at that point to sort of represent my voice in some way, which I didn't feel this sort of the working class roots were always in there, but I didn't know exactly how to express it. And in fact, as a young man, when you're working in the arts, you realize that a lot of people don't come from the same background that I came from.
That so many people, to be able to afford to work in the arts, something's coming from home every month.
That's right. That's right. Because you need that sort of incubation period as an artist, which isn't financeable by in any sort of a commercial way. So,
yeah, but everybody in the entertainment industry is a startup.
That's right. That's right. You need some way in which you can essentially flail around and figure out who you are artistically. And you have to get through those years. You have to have a place to live and you have to be able to eat and stuff while that's going on. And so that makes it so that a lot of people who come from backgrounds like mine don't have an opportunity to be an artist. But for whatever reason, I don't exactly know why, I sort of made it through that.
Yeah.
And you often hear that in the arts, people who it works out for either come from very disadvantaged backgrounds or very wealthy backgrounds. And at any rate, I wound up making a film called Haiku Tunnel, and I think there's some real political point of view in that film. I think I thought of it as sort of a modern times for the modern age. It was sort of like a comedy about an office temp secretary who gets 17 letters to mail at the beginning of the movie and spends the whole movie not mailing them because he's sort of resisting the system in some – is a you know, sort of comic absurdist piece, but one I'm really proud of. And then I started to sort of expand a little bit. I made a drama called The Best Thief in the World about growing up in Washington Heights when I was a kid in New York. And that starred Mary Louise Parker and Audra McDonald and a bunch of actors from the New York theater scene that I had a lot of admiration for. And then And then I sort of had to figure out who I was. I had a bunch of success, relatively speaking, in the film industry on an indie film level. A lot of people respected me as an artist, but I hadn't yet sort of made anything that sort of had hit in some sort of commercial way. And I didn't know what that was going to be, honestly. I didn't know exactly what – the second film was a drama, a personal drama. The first one was a comedy. So what are you going to do with me in a commercial sense?
Right. If you're an agent or a studio, it's like, who is he?
Who is he? Yeah. So basically, that led to a lot of soul searching and a lot of thinking about who I was and what I wanted to do. And it led me to leave the film centers of L.A. and New York and move up to Northern California. And I landed in Berkeley, California, where actually my brother lives. That was the reason for going up there. But it was so nice to get out of the sort of commercial industry, if you will, and sort of really get to ask myself, like, what do I care about? What's the things that really matter to me? This happened to be coincidentally around the time that the economy was crashing in 2008, 2009. And I had just about had it. I felt like this was the story of our times, the biggest story of our times. And the discussion I was hearing about it in the 24-hour news cycle was woefully lacking in its ability to meet the challenge that I felt like our country was facing. So many of my friends were so financially they had so much financial anxiety. We all did. We were thinking about how we stacked up relative to our parents. We were thinking about how we might pay for health care, how we might save for retirement. Pay student loans. A lot of student loan problems. And we sat around talking about this, and we sat around talking about how, you know, the left thinks this, or we talked about it in sort of really partisan terms, or a lot of people were talking about it in really partisan terms. And I didn't get it. I didn't understand in a sort of the big picture what it all meant. I certainly had heard that income inequality was growing, and I knew that it was one of the sort of big elements to probably it fit in somewhere in this puzzle of the problem that was going on. But around 2008, 2009, I started diving in and realizing that not only did I think that what this widening divide was the story of our time, but that it was affecting everything. As you said at the beginning of the show, it was affecting our economy and our democracy. And it was probably true that we weren't ever going to be able to fix any of this stuff if we didn't understand this in a different way.
Great. That's the voice of Jacob Kornbluth. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. And Jacob is the director of the documentary Inequality for All, starring Robert Reich. It opened in 23 cities last Friday night. It opens in another 13 cities next week. In L.A., you can see it at the Landmark West L.A. and the ArcLight Hollywood. You can learn more at inequalityforall.com and robertreich.org. And in the latter third of the show, I'm going to be joined by Harvey Wasserman. We're going to talk about what's going on at Fukushima in Japan. Thank you. That was great in terms of the personal, the artistic, and the political all in one big chunk there. So you're sitting in Berkeley. You say, unless we can really begin to connect dots and understand this, we're just going to be talking to ourselves.
That's right.
And then?
Well, I was trying to make a comedy, and I tried to cast Robert Reich in it. I thought, what an amazing presence, and he lives in Berkeley. So why don't I give him a call? And it turns out he is pretty accessible up there. You can get to him. And we met, and it did not work out for the comedy. But it turns out that we became friends almost immediately. We really shared a sensibility. He's an incredibly funny and warm human being. And we started discussing what we might do together. I had been thinking about maybe there was a way into this economics and politics stuff. And I'm a filmmaker. What is it? And then he and I started talking about it. And we started making these really these short videos, 2 minutes long, 3 minutes long, and putting them on YouTube. I put them on YouTube.
And were these the ones where it was the writing on the board and that sort of work?
That's right.
Kind
That's
of like
right.
what Free Range Studios has done?
That's – well, except Free Range Studios does it in animated way. And Reich actually draws all those pictures, believe it or not. But we started – yeah, they became the ones with those pictures in it. And what was fascinating about it was hundreds and thousands of people started watching them. And it gave me the confidence that there was an audience for stuff like this, stuff that sort of broke down complex issues in ways that everybody could understand, did in a visual way, and maybe gave something, contributed something to the discussion past, say, the books that Bob was writing
and,
or the blog he was writing.
And you had found really, I mean, I quoted Ken Turan about him in the intro. You had found someone who has the credibility, the expertise, the accessibility. Mm-hmm. I mean, that in this, I mean, for what you're doing, he's almost the perfect star, the perfect vehicle.
You know, I thought about that a lot. That's probably why the movie was even possible to conceive of, because he's such a perfect vehicle to understanding this. His personal story is so appealing. He's such a wonderful on-camera presence. His warmth as a person off-camera comes across on-camera. And for a lot of people who think about economics and politics, they might come across as, I don't know what you'd say, like wonky?
Yeah, wonky was the word that was in my head. I was waiting to see if that's what you were going to say.
So his real gift is to be brilliant, but also accessible and break it down.
And the other thing is, of all these economists, he's the one that when I went to a particular Occupy demonstration down in L.A., he came down from Berkeley to speak.
I mean, I was there shooting. I saw you there.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And I
that made it in the film.
I recognized the footage when I saw the film. But, I mean, not that many were heading over to Occupy settlements.
Yeah. No, that's right. One of the interesting stories relative to the film is that the starting of the film predated the Occupy movement. So when we first started making the film,
Tea Party existed, but not Occupy.
Tea Party was there, but no Occupy. And there was not a lot of sort of momentum to make a film like this when we started. Now, I think you're in the middle of sort of pushing this thing forward, and then this amazing movement sprouts up, and you have no idea what it's going to mean for the film. And one of the beautiful things was being able to go to those events with him and see them through his eyes and walk around with him and have people shake his hand and you know, meet him and try and get a real feel for the events. He and I went to them in several different cities around the country, and it was – they were fascinating.
Yeah,
really good.
Absolutely. That's the voice, as I said before, of Jacob Kornbluth. He is the director of Inequality for All. It opened this past weekend, the 27th, in 23 cities. It spreads to another 13 next week. And we're going to talk also about when it'll be in DVD and direct-to-video and when you can get it for your school or your church as the interview goes on. So I was going to ask, what came first, the issue of inequality or Robert Reich in terms of this film? And it sounds like there would be no film without Robert Reich, and the inequality was eating at you before you thought there might be a film.
That's exactly right. I mean, one of the fascinating things is, as a filmmaker, is trying to make sure you don't miss what's right in front of your nose. You know, here's an issue that I really care about, that I'm really passionate about personally, that I've been thinking about my whole life and sort of thinking at this time about what I can do with. And then I also happen to know the single best, you know, speaker, articulate
messenger
for this particular message at the same time. Well, that seems like, you know, if that's not something hitting you in the face, then you're not looking. So it is true that they both went together. And it also happened, there was another key piece to this, which is that he was at the time writing a book, and he showed me an early manuscript. And it was still one of those things that I remember fondly, is getting a Word document of a book that Robert Reich had written and getting to see, you know, be one of the first readers of it. And it really feeling like it blew my mind, and sort of it was a little bit paradigm shifting for me. It was not a here's the bad guy's book. It wasn't, which is sort of interesting new framing of it for me. It wasn't so much like, look at how bad the rich are for this or whatever. It was more like, this is a structural problem that's affecting everybody. This inequality affects us all. That's one of the reasons why we called it Inequality for All.
Right. And also why I quoted as, I think, the most important number in the film being that the economy is 70% consumer spending.
Exactly right.
That I think if there was a key message here, it's the one that no matter what the 1% think they're doing, the economy works best for them and for everyone when the middle class flourishes.
Absolutely true. Well, you can see it so clearly in the movie when you see the 30 years after the Second World War, you see that the 1% had between 9 and 11% of national income during that period, and we had the greatest economic expansion in the history of mankind, maybe. And then you have the last 30 or 40 years where the 1% is getting a steadily rising share of national income and wealth, and the economy has been much more stagnant. And you see, especially since 2008, well, surprisingly, the economy has grown 28% or so since 1999, and the middle class's share of that has gone down, and the 1% has grown up. This is we've seen in history, and we see it in the movie, that when wealth and income get too unequal, something bad happens after that for our economy. And we saw that certainly in 2008, and we saw it in 1929 after the two biggest peak years of income inequality in the last
right. century. There's this image that you use in the film a number of times, which is the Golden Gate Bridge and the rising arches of it. And one is 28 and one is 08. And they're the extremes. And it's that time in the middle when everybody's sharing. And I have, as I said, interviewed Robert several times. And it was back on his book, Super Capitalism, that mm-hmm. we talked about the golden age of America. Aside from if you were African American or gay or those sorts of things, when it was not perhaps a golden age, but for the mass of people in America, it worked for everyone. And the film sets out, I guess, to say how can we get back there. A couple of questions. At what point did you know you had a theatrical release? Because that is, you know, that doesn't happen to a lot of even very good documentaries.
That's absolutely right. I mean, we've passed so many very small bottlenecks to get this film to where it is. It's really an amazing journey when you take a film to this place. But we started to feel pretty early on. I knew that Reich was such an amazing character for the film. So you sort of had this feeling early on when we were screening it for people that we were maybe onto something. But the film didn't work for a very long time because there's so many threads of the story that all felt like separate pieces. It felt like maybe you were watching four movies instead of one movie until pretty close to it getting done. So I would say it wasn't until the first screening at Sundance. We had a screening at Sundance. We had gotten into the festival, which is an amazing accomplishment for a film. But then we had our first screening, and you could sort of feel it in the room that people were on the train with the film. They were sort of feeling it. And then when the film ended, we went up, and I remember I went up first, and then Bob came up after, and we got a 5-minute standing ovation. And it's one of those moments as a filmmaker you never forget, you know, people appreciating your work like that. And then there was a lot of interest from distributors about how, you know, who's going to put this out and how. And so we sort of had a sense around Sundance time that it was going to work theatrically and maybe come out. You know, we sold the film to the Weinstein Company Radius Division there, and they've been amazing, supportive partners in trying to get this out, and they believe in it as much as we do.
Very good. That's the voice of Jacob Kornbluth, and I'm Terrence McNally, and we're talking about the film Inequality for All. It stars Robert Reich. I think that's the right way to put it. I was trying to think features. No, it stars Robert Reich. And it talks about all that Robert's been writing for years and that is so pertinent to this moment. And you can learn more at inequalityforall.com and robertreich.org. I want to talk a little bit more about the content of the film, which we have done. Early in the film, we see Robert Reich, and you return to this a few times, in addressing a class, a packed, huge lecture mm-hmm. hall. As much as we hear, you don't want to take lectures with 700 people in them or whatever that lecture hall holds. If it's Robert Reich, maybe you don't mind. But it's a film he teaches on wealth and poverty at UC Berkeley, packed house. And he tells the class that he aims first to deal with three questions. Mm-hmm. What is happening in the U.S. in terms of distribution of income and wealth? Why is it happening, and is it a problem? And it reminded me, sometimes I do a format on this show which actually fits this conversation, which I call It's Broke, Let's Fix It. And I ask three questions. How do we know it's broken? What's the evidence? Mm-hmm. Whatever the issue is. How did it get broken? What's the history? Who are the culprits? How do we fix it, right? And those three fit very well, actually, in your film. And in the first question, how do we know it's broken? Those numbers I said at the top, right? Mm-hmm. But any more you want to throw out, what's the evidence that distribution in America is broken?
Well, I think you mentioned a lot of them at the top of the show. The other one is during what we call the Great Prosperity in the movie, the middle part of the century, the top 1% was taking home between 9 and 11% of the national income. In the two peak years before the greatest crashes, 1928 and 2007, they took home around 23% of national income. This trend essentially started in the late 70s and climbs right up steadily until a crash. That shows me that it's broken, and that when it's broken, there are consequences to it. So that's why that graph is so powerful to me. Then you have just like some of the sort of grotesque numbers of income inequality. The things like CEOs used to make, 30 times what the average worker in a corporation makes. Now, depending on the measure you look at, something around 350 times is the number that you hear so often cited. Something feels to me sort of flawed in a society that is built like that. I mean, one of the crazy things or interesting things about the study of economics that was in this class was in the film that we took out is that the study of economics is about 100 years old. And before that, they used to call it political economics. It used to be tied to politics. And when John Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, the sort of capitalist Bible in the 1700s, he was called a moral philosopher. Now, the fascinating thing about that is that the study of economics is about what is a good society. How do we get together in a way that sort of is good for everybody or sort of maxes out the benefit to the most citizens? What's the best way to encourage incentives for people to innovate mixed in with what's good for people? That's what economics should be. And when you have a society where a CEO of a corporation is making 350 times what the average worker is, something fundamental is broken not only in the economics but in the society that takes place in. And I think that was a fundamental truth about the film that I think we sort of play out statistically.
Yeah. And by the way, if people Robert was recently on, and there's an interview with you also, at Bill Moyer's website. And do you know what Bill Moyer's website is called? Is it BillMoyers.com?
I believe it's BillMoyers.com.
I think it is. Okay. And he had Robert on to talk about inequality for all. On the website, there's a 13-minute interview with you, Jacob. But also, he does a great job on the website of statistics.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
got the problem, the work, the cost, the inequality. If you need any more evidence of how broken things are, check out the Inequality for All segment at BillMoyers.com.
You could also check inequalityforall.com, which has not only a bunch of statistics around this topic, but also a bunch of ways you can get involved to do something about
it. We're definitely going to get into that. Absolutely, Inequality for All. And then RobertReich.com, where he has his blogs and great stuff. And I mean, I'm going to take a moment to point out some other books that I think are really pertinent here. One is The Spirit Level, which I was surprised you didn't refer to. You know the book, right?
Mm-hmm.
So The Spirit Level is this epidemiological study done by a couple of epidemiologists, which normally study public health, and they found that in societies that have the greatest inequality, things are worse on every sort of measurement for everybody, for the wealthy as well as the poor, as well as the middle class, and for the societies, Japan, Denmark, so on, where inequality is least, things across the board are better for everybody. It's a dry work, but it's really an important finding. Winner Take All Politics, which does a great job of laying out the politics of what changed over the last 30 years. And then I think the two books, Who Killed the American Dream and Who Killed and Who Stole, one by Hedrick Smith and one by, I'm forgetting the two, Bartlett and Steele, are also great books that sort of lay all of this out. You have a wonderful interview with Nick Hanauer, who is very wealthy. He has his own companies. He funds startups and so on, an angel investor, and he says some interesting things.
Yeah, he says he makes a 10 or 8 figure salary. He makes between $10 million and $30 million a year. He's a passionate capitalist, and he's also passionate about ending income inequality. And that's what makes him such an interesting character for the film, because he's the wealthy guy in this film is not a villain, but he's also not, you know, a lefty, if you will. You know, I mean, he might be. I don't know his politics, but he's certainly passionate about making a lot of money. And what's fascinating about his perspective is that he believes in widening income inequality as a problem because he wants the middle class to have more money in their pockets so he can figure out more ways to sell them stuff.
Yeah. His family, I think, comes – his original family business was pillows.
Pillows, yeah.
And he says, I make 10 to 30 million. I cannot buy 1,000 pillows a year.
Yeah.
I can't make up for the middle class person who can't afford to buy pillows.
And he thinks he's such a savvy businessman that if middle class consumers had more money in their pockets – he, as such a good businessman, could figure out more ways to get them, you know, to come up with products that they might want. So this is frustrating to him, this widening economic inequality from a business perspective, which is something we need to hear a lot more about. I mean, it's true that if the economy were doing better, businessmen would have more opportunities to sell people stuff. And what an interesting way into this, to this discussion. So that's what made him such a compelling character in the movie. He's surprising the people when they see him in this film.
Yeah, he's great. This is Freeform. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Jacob Kornbluth, director of the documentary Inequality for All, starring Robert Reich. It opened in 23 cities on the 27th of September. It opens in another 13 week following, and then will continue to spread in L.A. You can see it at the Landmark West L.A. and the Arclight Hollywood. You can learn more at inequalityforall.com and robertreich.org. In a few minutes, I'll be joined by Harvey Wasserman. We'll have an important update on the situation at the Stricken nuclear power plant in Fukushima, Japan. This is Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. For this week's conversation and many others, along with articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, get a look at some of the work I do with story and narrative with organizations, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and four or five articles of background, sign up at my site or email me at TEMcNally, TEMcNally, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Freeform Podcast on iTunes. You can check out Freeform with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. The second question I mentioned, how did it get broken? What's the history? Who are the culprits? We talked a bit about that, but as you just said, since pragmatically it is best for the wealthy when the income is spread around, what happened? Why did we – what happened in those 30 years from, say, 78 to 2008?
Well, I mean, the simple factors that led to this problem are globalization and technological change. We say it really clearly in the movie. People have known about these issues for a long time. I think Reich has a funny line in the movie where he says, globalization, globalization, globalization. Rarely have you seen a word go so quickly from obscurity to meaninglessness with no intervening period of coherence. And I think that the people have heard these words, again, just like the issue of widening income inequality generally. The real I had heard the buzzwords of 99% and 1%, and I'll get back to your question in a second. But I hadn't really had a context to kind of understand why I should care, why it really matters to me, and like a really – other than it's bad to sort of have this. But I needed to sort of connect the dots here. And then – so globalization and technology are what caused this change. But so often the second part of that discussion when you – there's nothing we could have done about it. You know, there's nothing we could have done. Look at globalization and technologies happening all over the world. You know, isn't it? It's just too bad that everybody lost their jobs. That's just fundamentally, it's sort of a economic determinist model, which
and is inaccurate.
It's false. That's the problem. We have to be able to say globalization and technology on one part of, you know, out of one part of the story, and then say, we simply must, as a nation, figure out how to organize our economy and our democracy in such a way to deal with these changes. I mean, it's important. It's important that our people get
And not just that, Jacob. Germany provides the outstanding example And the way it shows up in the film is when Robert Reich asks his class at Berkeley how much of an iPhone's value comes from which countries, assuming people will think, well, a certain amount from America, a certain amount from China, that's about it. It turns out that 34% is from Japan, which I'm not sure why that is, but 17% of the value of an iPhone is Germany. And I've pointed it out on this show before. Germany made a decision when globalization happened that they would get better and better at having the people who could make precise quality manufactured products, and they would make that what they did, and they have done that. America made a decision, the very wealthy, I think, and some of the multinationals made a decision, we will farm out our labor to
That's
cheaper
right.
countries, and we will become consumers rather than producers.
Well, it's also true that you recall earlier we talked about how in the middle part of the century, the top 1% in America was taking home between 9 and 11% of national income. Well, in Germany, in 2007, when in America it was at over 23% of national income, in Germany it was between 9 and 11%. So the organization of their overall economy is and was at that time similar to what America was during our great prosperity years when we had the greatest economic expansion in the history of the world. So you see that dots are sort of connected a little bit. And, you know,
I want to jump in 1 second because we're on the question of how did it happen. And I think inequality for all leaves it out, but I'm curious what your answer is. When you go to winner-take-all politics and some of the other places that have looked at this 30-year history, they also see that it was not just globalization technology. There was a concerted effort by a certain segment of the very wealthy, starting with the Lewis Powell memo and saying we can transform the Chamber of Commerce into something which works for us politically. The ultimate of that is Citizens United, the Koch brothers, the Adelsons, and so on. So there has been a political track that has set out to make this this inequality a U.S. policy.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I think what I've seen is you see – I get asked all the time at screenings, why are people – not acting in their self-interest economically. And that's a big what's the matter with Kansas type question.
Right.
But you do definitely see that these great lies repeated over and over again, as Orwell said, are eventually taken as truth. You see the tying in of freedom, these sort of words like freedom, but it's sort of the survival of the fittest theory where if you failed economically, if you're going downhill, if you're in a downward escalator, it's your fault, man. It's not our fault as a society. It's your fault because, hey, we all had freedom of opportunity. Well, what you see in this widening income inequality is opportunity to sort of rise out of poverty in America is going down as income inequality goes up.
That's right. I was going to say the ace in the hole for the U.S. for so long was upward mobility. You
could
say, well, we've got very rich or we pollute or whatever it was, but you get upward mobility, anybody can come here and have. It turns out that upward mobility is declining to the point that the chance that kids born – and these are quotes from your film – the chance that kids born in poverty will not get out in the U.S. is 42% now. The chance if you're born in poverty you will never get out of poverty is 42%. In Denmark, it's only 25%. You've got a 3 out of 4 chances of getting out. In the U.K., which we know still has royalty, mm-hmm. it's 30%. It is significantly worse in America, one of the lies that still gets perpetrated.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Let's go to the third question, which is what are the solutions? What do we do about this? Now, obviously, make a film like this is one, but what else?
Well, in the very most basic way, we have to fight, particularly people my age and younger, have to fight cynicism. Because people like me who grew up, people of Reich's generation and older, which is probably a generation older than me, they saw social change work. They saw, you know, the civil rights movement, the fight against the Vietnam War. They had this sort of fundamental belief that we can change things if we get together and do it. And I never had that example growing up. I've been growing up in this during this period of widening income inequality, and that really affected me, and I think it affects a lot of people. This sort of pull towards cynicism.
Resignation.
That's right.
It's the way it is.
It's the way it is. We can't do anything about it. So I'm just going to have a cup of coffee and go to sleep or whatever. You know, you probably wouldn't do those things at once, but you know what I'm saying.
or go to sleep.
or go to sleep. Have a cup of coffee or go to sleep. Not have a cup of coffee and go to sleep. Anyway, cynicism's the big enemy here. We have to believe we can do something. There's this great story that Reich often tells about a woman going up to FDR in 1936, I think, and saying, "Mr. President, you have to do this laundry list of things. You have to change this. You have to change that." And then he grabs her arm back and he says, "Ma'am, I'd love to do those things, but you have to make me." And what I love about that story is we all believe, like, man, these politicians are letting us down. And I certainly was thinking that they're not doing enough to fix the problem. And it certainly is true. But the responsibility is ours as citizens. It's important that we feel energized to do something about it. And to me, you know, it's a little touchy-feely sounding maybe, but that seems to be the biggest obstacle is just this perception. I mean, so much money is in the hands of so few. They control so much of the media. This filters and politics. We feel defeated by it. We sort of cede democracy to these people, and then it gets worse. It's sort of a downward negative cycle. And the first step is to have enough of us get the thought in our head that this economy, this sort of supposed free market system, is just a set of rules that about how we organize ourselves that we can change. And if we can sort of fundamentally change that chip, I think we're getting somewhere. Now, there's probably a really important policy discussion to have after, you know, like after you get that chip.
After you get energized, after you set, yes.
But it's almost ludicrous to have the policy discussion because it feels futile to me in a certain way until we sort of can change this basic perception.
Yeah, I would say sometimes I think that the odds have never been as stacked against the people as they are now because of Citizens United. There's another ruling about to come up from the Supreme Court soon that may erase all limits on individual giving. And the organization that has happened since the 70s of the business lobbies and so on, leading to the Adelsons and the Koch brothers and so on. I think if you go back, there were the smoke-filled rooms. Mm-hmm. In other words, now it looks like, oh, politics is locked up. I think it used to be locked up in a very different way by the machines and so on.
That's right.
So there's always been a certain people with their hand on the scale.
That's right.
And it still means that if we band together, if we take this seriously, we can make a difference. The odds are stacked, but they're always stacked. That's the way power works.
But there's more of us than there are of them.
That's right. On election day and any time that one asks to hear from the people, we outnumber them. I want to mention just a couple before I let you go. I want to mention a couple of the moments that really stuck out for me. One is the woman who in the discussion of executive pay and deregulation and so on, there's a woman who looks at the camera and says, "If you have 10 million, if you have a billion, why do you need the little bit that I have?" Just talk about shooting that moment.
You know, it was first of all, she's a Republican and a Mormon, and she happens to be at a union rally, very confused moment for this room, or very charged moment when some people are for and some are against the union. And she's trying to piece together what she thinks of it all and wrestling with a series of conflicting things, probably what she hears from people in her conservative world and things that she feels about how this game just doesn't seem right. And what an amazing moment. She's wearing like a pink jumpsuit and you know, she has this great blonde hair and she sits down and she's so unguarded. She's just speaking her thoughts and feelings without thinking about how it fits into a political view. And that's what's so beautiful about it. You know, she's really, her emotions are raw, but she's not clear about what she's after. There's no agenda behind it. She's just saying, how come this is the way it is?
And she's not angry at that moment.
She's not.
She's just almost plaintive.
Yeah.
You know.
I found her incredibly compelling. Because of that interview, we followed that couple as a series of characters.
Now then there's another moment which comes very near the end of the film, which is when Robert Reich is explaining why he has fought the bullies, why he has dedicated his life's career. And he talks about, being as short as he is, he's 4'10". That when he was a teenager, he figured out that if he could align himself with a bodyguard, a protector, they would protect him from the bullies. And one of them was an older kid at camp named Mickey Schwerner.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's first of all, Bob was very reticent to talk about his personal story. I mean, he's certainly been out there talking about this issue for a long time, but his personal story, he wasn't that comfortable talking about it. And it just took a long time to get to it. And I had to convince him that people had to get to know the messenger here to sort of really have the message land. But that particular story is important because Mickey Schwerner was one of the people gathering votes in Mississippi or organizing people
to register
to vote in Mississippi.
In Freedom Summer.
And it was a powerful story for the country. And it sort of connects up the personal of – this was – Mickey was Bob's protector. And it, before he became a name, before he was somebody who was a player
He was one of the three murdered.
That's right.
During Freedom Summer, Schwerner, Goodman, and I forget the third name. But when he saw his protector – he realized who the real bullies were,
and then
he says that moment changed his life.
He didn't even know it, I don't think, or wasn't able to articulate it until relatively recently. But this changed the way he approached his whole life because he had to, in some way, stand up against the real bullies, the economic bullies who are pushing around average folks, you know, every day. And this gave his life purpose. And it's amazing to see Bob's personal journey line up with the larger story of economic inequality in America.
Thank you. The film is Inequality for All, starring Robert Reich. It opened in 23 cities on the 27th, opens in another 13 the next weekend, and will spread throughout the country. In L.A., you can see it now at the Landmark West L.A. and the Arclight Hollywood. You can learn more at inequalityforall.com and robertreich.org. And as I said, there's also a really good segment on the film and a lot of good information at billmoyers.com. Jacob Kornbluth, keep up the good work.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a moment to speak with Harvey Wasserman with an important update on the situation at the stricken nuclear power plant in Fukushima, Japan. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome back to Freeform. Harvey Wasserman is a teacher, author, and activist focusing primarily on election protection and nuclear power. With Bob Fitrakis, Harvey helped break many of the major stories surrounding the 2004 presidential election in Ohio. In 1973, Wasserman helped pioneer the global grassroots movement against atomic reactors. He was an organizer of 1979's No Nukes concerts featuring Bruce Springsteen, Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Browne, and many others. He edits the nukefree.org website, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E, nukefree.org website, and he's the senior editor of freepress.org. Wasserman is author or co-author of a dozen books, including Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030, Welcome again to Free Forum, Harvey Wasserman.
Terry, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Okay. As I've said throughout the show, I want you to give us an update on Fukushima. Now, first, remind us, when did the crisis begin? Where do things stand? And are things getting better or worse?
Well, Terry, I hate to tell you, it's been a 2.5-year nightmare for me. And it started on March 11th, 2011. There was an earthquake about 120 kilometers off the coast of Japan, a 9.0, which is about as big as we've recorded. And it was followed by a tsunami, of course, as we all know. And the terrifying pictures are up at YouTube if you got the stomach for it. But the earthquake did tremendous damage to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear setup on the coast of Japan. There are six reactors there. Thankfully, two of them, units 5 and 6, were shut, and they are higher up in the air. They actually, one of them, they did have a generator that retained electrical power there, so they did not suffer the tremendous damage that units 1, 2, 3, and 4 did. Now, these are General Electric designed reactors. There are two dozen of them similar in the United States. And we also have two reactors in California at Diablo Canyon, which are in earthquake zones and could be hit by tsunamis. We have, to the great credit of the people of Southern California, shut the two reactors permanently that were still operating at San Onofre between L.A. and San Diego.
The last time you were on the show, Harvey, that's what we were talking about.
Yeah,
could we shut down San Onofre? And we did.
Well, we are happy to say there will be no Fukushima at San Onofre, but the Fukushima at Fukushima is plenty difficult. Now, we're facing a major crisis coming up in November. the utility company, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, which has been completely incompetent throughout this whole situation, starting with the actual building of the reactors, which was greatly resisted by the Japanese people. I was in Japan in the mid-1970s. I actually wrote an article about Fukushima that was published in the Progressive magazine saying, what are you doing building nuclear plants in an earthquake zone that gets washed by tsunamis? And the utility and all of them said, no, 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 it can't happen. And, of course, here it has happened.
Now, did they say it couldn't happen or that they, even if it did happen, they had a design that would withstand and all of that sort of thing?
Yes, both. They said both. They said the odds on an earthquake followed by a tsunami big enough to matter were minuscule, and that even on such a case that they could deal with it. And, of course, they haven't been able to. Now, the current situation, and we are circulating a petition at nukefree.org that we will hand in. We just passed 40,000 signatures to ask the United Nations to step in and take over at Fukushima. For lack of a better global body, the fact is that a private utility company, even one as big as TEPCO, is not capable of handling this situation. Neither is the Japanese government. We're not even sure there's enough technical expertise in the world of our species to handle what's going on there.
Okay, let me stop you for a second. That's Harvey Wasserman. We're talking about the situation that persists at Fukushima, where the nuclear plant suffered earthquake followed by tsunami. Why do you say November is critical?
The Tokyo Electric Power Company has said that in November they will attempt to remove a spent core, about 1,500 or so spent fuel rods, about 400 tons of material, which is in a spent fuel pool, which is perched 100 feet in the air. Now, you have to suspend your imagination here. General Electric designed these reactors, and they're about half the world's 400 reactors are GE designs, with a spent fuel pool 100 feet in the air.
Why?
What's their
design idea?
Because it was easier to pull the fuel rods out of the core and swing them up. They were already 100 feet in the air and swing them up into a pool at the top of the reactors. It's an insane design.
Now, when you say 100 feet in the air, I mean, the 10th story of a building is 100 feet in the air.
Correct.
But you figure it's pretty solid. What are these? These are pools of water.
Correct.
On stilts?
Well, no, they're lodged in buildings. The problem at Fukushima Unit 4, now you have to remember Fukushima Units 1, 2, and 3, the cores did melt. And after 2.5 years, we don't know where they are. They melted into the ground probably through the reactor buildings. You have three hot cores somewhere in the earth at Fukushima. They're pouring water in the hope to keep them cool. Nobody knows if the water's even getting to them.
So I'm going to stop you again because we have so much to catch up with on what you're saying. You're sort of embedded in this material all the time.
Oh God, so, I guess that's one way to put it. Yeah.
So when the core, you're saying the core melted?
Three of them.
They melted.
Correct.
So there's a nuclear core.
Three of them.
And three of them, and they melt, and you're saying at that point we don't know or even they don't know?
Nobody knows. They don't know where they are. They can't find them. You can't go in there. It's too radioactive. So they're pouring water onto the site in the hope that it's reaching these cores and keeping them cool. There have been we believe they're way cooled down than where they were, but we still don't know. And there have been some steam eruptions at Fukushima where those three cores might be.
So a steam eruption would indicate that something's not as cool as you want it to be.
Absolutely correct. And there is a aquifer underneath, and you know the worst case scenario is that a molten hot core melts its way into an aquifer, creates a steam explosion, blows the place all to hell, and a huge quantity of radiation is released.
Now, all these you said that in November, TEPCO plans to move.
Well, here's the situation.
Over 1,000 rods.
Correct.
So these are the spent rods that have already fueled the plant, but they're still.
Well,
what's the situation of a spent rod?
Well, this is at Unit 4, Terry. Unit 4, when the earthquake hit, they had pulled the core out, and it was in the pool 100 feet in the air, and they were doing basic maintenance. But the core itself, a spent fuel core, or, you know, the rods, are capable of releasing gargantuan quantities of radiation. The general estimate now is that the core, the 1,500 or so rods in the spent fuel pool at Unit 4 – which did not explode, although there was an explosion in Unit 4. We believe it was a hydrogen explosion. So the building itself in which the spent fuel pool is supported is weakened.
By that explosion.
Yes, and because there's so much water pouring through the site, the ground has gotten soft. So the building that's supporting the fuel pool at Unit 4 is sinking and tilting. And God forbid another earthquake should come or the thing should give way. The fuel
and the
pool would crash to the ground.
And the constant pouring of water only exaggerates that, right?
Yes, on the ground.
Yeah.
Now, somehow, miraculously, they've been able to keep the keep the fuel rods covered with water at Unit 4. But the fuel rods are clad in zirconium alloy, which is highly flammable. You know, the zirconium was the element in the old flash cubes. Then, so it burns very hot, very fast, very bright. God forbid zirconium alloy clad rods would be exposed to air. They would catch fire. And the radiation in the rods would be released into the atmosphere. There is a possibility, if it got hot enough, that you could have a fission explosion, which would mimic an atomic bomb. This place is 155 miles from Tokyo. So, 13,000 Hiroshima bombs is a very significant number in terms of radiation releases. And unfortunately for us in California, the radiation from Fukushima after the 3/11/11 earthquake and tsunami was detected here. Radiation came from Chernobyl within 10 days. Here it's come from, Japan's a lot closer, 5 or 6 days.
Does it come through the air, through the water, or both?
Yes, both. It does. And the amounts of radiation being poured into the Pacific are catastrophically large. A lot of it is cesium, which is really toxic.
You've got 2 minutes left. One of the reasons that you want global control of this, and the UN is the body you're turning to in your petition, is that there has been either obfuscation,
incompetence, misinformation. We don't believe that Tokyo Electric Power or the government of Japan have the resources to bring down these fuel rods safely. We don't think that they.
So your petition says give another authority. By November?
Yeah. Well, we want the United Nations to take over, and we want to establish an independent organization of scientists and engineers. As a species, our entire resources should be focused on bringing these fuel rods down from Unit 4. That's the number one issue facing the survival of the human race now, right now. And I know this sounds hyperbolic. But the fact of the matter is that with 13,000 potential for releasing 13,000 Hiroshima bombs, this fuel core has to be brought to the ground at nukefree.org, nukefree.org. We're circulating this petition through Move On. And as I say, we've got 40,000 signatures so far without barely breaking a sweat. So we've got to get this done.
Can you also find the petition at moveon.org?
Yes, you can go to moveon.org or nukefree.org.
Or nukefree, N-U-K-E, free.org, either one of those. And when you say 40,000, my guess is from all over the globe.
Oh, yeah, they're from everywhere. And we will present these to the United Nations at the end of October. However many we have, I'm hoping we have more than 100,000. But we will present these in New York and desperately beg the United Nations and the global scientific community to step in here. Because if they mess this up, we're in really, really serious trouble. We're already in serious trouble. But this is a primary moment, moving this fuel assembly down to the ground and getting it covered up. It's a Damocles sword over the entire human race. Certainly it will affect people in California. We need to get this done. So nukefree.org, moveon.org, sign the petition, please.
Okay, very good. That's to get some sort of global expertise to come in and take over at Fukushima before they do this incredibly precarious, dangerous task.
Exactly right, Terry.
Okay. I'm again Terrence McNally. I've been speaking with Harvey Wasserman about the situation at the Stricken Nuclear Power Plant in Fukushima, Japan. To learn more, go to harveywasserman.com. But to sign the petition, go to nukefree, nukefree.org or moveon.org. Thank you, Harvey Wasserman.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can get a look at my work with organizations on their stories, their narratives, their messages. Go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website if you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and four or five articles of background. Sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Freeform Podcast on iTunes. Thanks also to today's first guest, Jacob Kornbluth, director of the documentary Inequality for All, starring Robert Reich. It opened in 23 cities on September 27th in L.A. It's currently playing at the Landmark West L.A. and the Arclight Hollywood. It opens in another 30 cities next week. You can learn more at inequalityforall.com and robertreich.org. Thanks to Darren, my engineer today, to G and Stan Mizrahi in production, to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.